morning. Welcome. We're going to start our workshop day with some singing, praising the Lord in song. I'm going to use number 9 in the back page of your, I'm not sure what to call these, but program booklets. If you don't have one of these, it is also number 31 in the Zion's Praises in the racks. I will extol thee, O my God. So I will extol thee, O my God, and praise thee, O my King. Yea, every day and evermore, thy praises I will sing. Every day will I bless thee. Every day. Every day. Let's sing number 11, A Charge to Keep I Have.
Do me so, a charge to keep I have, a God to glorify, a
morning. Greetings in Jesus' name this morning. Why are you here? I want to stimulate you a little bit. Two questions. First one is, why are you here? This is the uncomfortable part where you want to slouch down in your seat and kind of be hidden. But I think we can all say we're here to learn. You know, I think even these three brethren are here to learn as well. Yesterday, I drove almost 4 hours round trip, and I attended a training event. It was about safety and some other training things. There was a lot of valuable information there. And, you know, throughout the day, we had breaks, and we talked about, that was an excellent class that we had. That was excellent safety stuff. You know, we need to take this back to our company, and we need to apply it. And, you know, they even gave us their information. They said, you know, if you have problems, here's my phone number, here's my email address, here's websites you can go, and you can search, and you can find information that can be helpful. We want to do everything we can to help you be successful. You know, I had even, you know, after a full day of learning, they give you a certificate to back it up. And, you know, at the end of the day, I had all this information. I had my certificate. I hopped in my truck, and I slid it in my center console. You know, tomorrow when I get into work, I'm going to have a choice to make. So the second question is, what are you going to do with the information you received today? You know, we can discuss at break today. We can say that was an excellent class. That was excellent training. That was good stuff. You know, these brethren, maybe we have some concerns about the curriculum, and we can go to them and express those concerns. But what if they don't do anything about it? Well, the Bible talks a little bit about this in Deuteronomy 5:1. You don't have to turn there, but I'll read that verse. It says, "And Moses called all Israel and said unto them, Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your ears this day, that ye may learn them and keep them and do them." That ye may learn them and keep them and do them. There's some action required. So I want to challenge you, not just say, amen, that was great, that was a good class, but tomorrow, you have a choice to make. In James 1, verse 22, it says, be not hearers only, but doers. We have to remember that when we learn, we also become accountable. We have more responsibility. Yesterday was about safety. Now I'm accountable. Now I have more responsibility tomorrow when I go into work to think about safety and what I learned. What am I going to do? How am I going to apply it? And same way for you. You have a new accountability, a new responsibility. What are you going to do with the information you receive today? Let's stand for prayer. Father in heaven, thank you for this day. Thank you for your blessings to us. Thank you that we can gather and learn more of your word. And Lord, pray that you would be with these brethren as they speak. Lord, give them wisdom. And pray, Lord, that we could have an open heart, open mind. And Lord, also pray that we could remember to not only say and hear, but also to do what is required and what you want us to do, Lord. That you would be with us throughout this day. In Jesus' name, amen. Get seated. All right, we're glad to have Brother Elmer Glick with us this morning, and he will be doing the introductions. Turn the time over to him.
Good morning, and God bless you for coming, and thank you for that excellent introduction. Yes, why are you here? Why did we come? And what will we do with what we learned today? And he said it so well. You know, we are here to serve you. In the back of the Christian Light catalog are pictures and email addresses and phone numbers of the school reps. You are encouraged to contact us. I also have some of my cards in the back. For some of you from northern Pennsylvania, Lester Burkholder would be your contact person. So feel free to avail yourself of the services that we do offer. And also, while it's on my mind, my forgetter keeps getting better. This is not usually when I mention it, but yes, we do want to hear from you curriculum issues. We have up in the hallway and curriculum a bookcase full of every piece of curriculum, light units, textbooks, and that is called our correction copy, which means if you find a mistake and you tell us, we enter it into that correction copy, and then when it comes up for reprint, we have an editor go through that correction copy and make corrections to the master file, which then goes to press, and the next edition will have your corrections in it. So please avail yourself of that opportunity. A bit of an introduction here this morning, and Justin wondered if I have a bio, and each of the brethren are going to give a short bio. My name is Elmer Glick. I'm from Slainsville, West Virginia. Although I often tell crowds like this that my speech does not yet betray me, I grew up in Pennsylvania, so I don't have the West Virginia accent. Maybe that'll still come. My wife and I moved there in the year 2000 with a few of our children to start a new work in a church, to pastor a church there. I was first introduced to Christian Light in 1982. Now, some of you don't remember 1982. I understand that. I began teaching in a Christian school in 1982 using the Christian Light curriculum, and then taught until we moved to West Virginia, and then I became an employee, and so that's why I'm here, and that's why I'm a school rep and visit some of your schools and am available for you in that. My work, in addition to workshop trips, teacher training in the summer, some of you have been to those trainings. Also, in the winter, I visit schools, am available by email and phone for consultation. And in between all that, I do some curriculum work. So that gives you a bit of a rundown of who I am and what I do. And I ask the brethren to do the same when they come up here to introduce their topic. I'd like for you to turn to the booklet. Does everyone have a booklet? Have you been picking them up back there? Thank you very much. Okay, first I'll turn just very briefly to the back. Inside the back is the itineraries. We have 5 trips this year and 12 different speakers. 5 trips and 12 speakers. So they are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We are now at Cornerstone Mennonite School in Romulus, New York. We have a workshop yet tomorrow in Myerstown, Pennsylvania, and then on Friday at Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and then trip 2 is completed. Trip 4 is also on the way, and they are in Tennessee today, and this then is their final day as they head home tomorrow. Trip 5 to Texas and Mexico is yet in the future. Trip 1 and 3 have been already completed. Now, if you turn inside the front cover, now the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 does pertain to you. We have the speakers' names with a number behind it. Some of us have done 1 trip, some have done 2, some have done 3. And only the ones with a 2 behind it are here today. And even that isn't quite true because Jacob Peters is not here. Jacob Peters was scheduled for this trip, and the program booklets were printed when he asked to be excused for family reasons. And so Mark Webb graciously consented to come at rather short notice. He was on this trip last year as well, so some of you may have met him before. And so that breaks it down as to who is here. So for today, with me is Mark Webb and Gary Horst. Turn now to the center of the booklet. In the center of the booklet, we have a registration. And if you've used COE, you know how to take tests out of light units. So sometime today before you leave, I want you to take this test out of the program booklet. And we're not going to give you a certificate today to hang on the wall, but if you come for teacher training, we do give a certificate. And again, some of you have those for certificates, but we don't give a certificate here. But I want every school and homeschool to fill out one registration, not per person, per school and homeschool. Give the names of the people attending and their position. Are they teacher, board member, parent? And then down below, what is the type of your school? How much curriculum do you use from Christian Light? And then on the back of that is a place to put your email address. And I will give you now and later as well. We have the school light lines. How many of you are receiving the school light lines? A number of you are. I would like the rest of you to get them as well. They're free, not just to schools, but to teachers. And it tells you on the back here how to get them, either by mail or by email. And this is for teachers, board members, whoever's interested. There are plenty back there on the table. If you are not getting them, please pick up a copy so that you have those dates, I mean those email and addresses. How many of you here are homeschoolers? And hands down, hands up, how many are getting the homeschooler's friend? Okay, so that's well covered. Have you seen the newest edition? This one just came out. So if you're not getting it, you can also have those sent to your home free. And even for teachers, there's excellent articles in here if you want to do both. Now, that was a bunny trail to get me to the email communications. If you're not getting any of these and want to put your email address on the back of the registration and then put light lines or homeschooler's friend in parentheses with your email. And I will take that back to the office. We are also developing an email list. We continue to have problems getting people informed. And so we'd like to use an email list to tell you about teacher trainings, workshops, homeschool conferences, different things of that nature. So if you care to give your email address and check whether you are a school or a homeschool, and I will take those back to the office as well. Across the page is an evaluation form. Now, I would like everyone to fill out one of those before you leave today. There was no registration fee, but there's an exit fee. You have to hand in one of these before they'll let. I'll have Nelson at the door guarding it, so big guy, you know. So it's easier to fill one of these than to try and tangle with Nelson. So God bless you as you fill those out. Be very frank and blunt with us. And on the back, you can put additional comments and suggestions for next year's workshops, and you can hand those in. I will have a box on the registration table to accept those for you. Now, I'd like to go forward with a few introductions, and I know I had a hand raised count, but I'd like all the homeschool families to please stand. If you're a homeschool mother or father, could you please stand? Okay, we have three represented here. Welcome. It's good to have you here. Now I'd like to recognize some school groups, and I don't know if I have them all, and the order is not important, but first of all the home folks from Cornerstone, these are our hosts today. They're doing a great job. Would they please stand? You've seen some of them up front. You'll see more in the kitchen and in the snack line, so that should work out. Thank you. You may be seated. Okay, all those from Union Valley, would you please stand? Union Valley teachers. Okay, welcome. All those from Christian Heritage in Utica, would you please stand? Good to have you here. You may be seated. All those from Liberty, Pennsylvania. Okay, we have some there. God bless you. Thank you for coming. All those from Northern Light in Belleville, New York. Okay, thank you very much for coming. Are there any schools that I missed? Anyone here that didn't stand yet? Except these two up here, and I'll get them later. Okay, thank you very much. God bless you. Now, We try to, at these events, have a bookstore come in and sell books. And we've done that some in the past. It did not work out here. Now, what we're doing in place of that is back on the registration table and on the book table, you'll find a two-sheet listing of books. Some of them are in our catalogs, many of them are not, but will be in the 2020 catalog, which is not out yet. So we prepared this to help you. Now, since we do not have books for sale here, we do have some of the newer books on display, if you want to look through them, see what they're like. And then I want everybody to pick up one of these free shipping cards. And even schools, you can order, if you order within the next 2 weeks, you can order curriculum or books, free shipping sent to your address. There's three ways you can do it. You can go into our website and in the comment section put in code 158, and it's on here, and then they will refund the shipping. In other words, if you go on the web, it will charge you shipping, but if you put 158 in the comments, it will refund it to your credit card. You can call the 800 number by phone and give the 158 code, or you can send this coupon by mail, postmarked no later than 2 weeks from today, and again, that will give the code. So we'd like to offer that to you as a service, since we do not have booksellers here today. Back in the foyer, before you go down the steps, on the right-hand side, is a table of free items. Help yourself. The light lines, as I mentioned, are there. There are some tracks there. There are some 2020 calendars on a cardstock. We still have lots of them, don't we? Take plenty. Take for your board members, your teachers, if they're not all here, take extra. They're here for the taking. The less we have to carry back with us, the better. So we have those things. And then down in the foyer are two tables. And please notice the difference. The display items have a little yellow sticker. They are not free. They are for you to pick up and look at. We have the newer books and newer curriculum. And at 11:30 today, we're going to look at that new curriculum, or at least tell you about it, and some of the new books. In 30 minutes, we can't cover all the books, but we will cover what we can. So feel free to avail yourself of that. Down in the foyer are two restrooms. There are also a setback in the school building. So use those as needed today. Also, just across from us here, but you need to go around by the U-shape, is the gym area, and that's where food will be provided at lunch and the break as well. So at 10:10, when we have a break, you can go to that location. Let's turn now to the program booklet, and I'll have some additional comments and announcements as we look at the program. Turn now inside the front cover. And the front cover has the theme, Understanding Ourselves and Others. And so this morning, just when I'm finished here at 9:35, Brother Mark Webb is going to address who are we, giving us a historical perspective of who we are so that we can better understand each other. Now there's a mistake here. That break is actually at 10:10. Although Mark has been getting finished early and giving you a bit more extra there. But at 10:10 will be a break. And then at 10:30, there will be three bells. Whenever you hear three bells, that means come to the next function. It may be here, but at 10:30, it may be here or the other two locations that we will tell you. Mainly what I want you to get is don't return here to go to your workshops. Go immediately to the workshop of your choice, which we are about to describe. Now, our group here is small, but we like small groups, so don't apologize. And I say that in case, and it happened just occasionally, that one of the workshops doesn't have any interest. And so if, and also occasionally we come to a workshop and maybe only one person's there, and a workshop with only one person gets a little awkward. So if you find yourself in an awkward place, don't hesitate going to another location. You won't hurt our feelings at all. I think we're pretty tough skinned. So don't come to a workshop just to make us feel good to have somebody there. Christian Light has, in 1976, now I know most of you don't remember that date either, brought out a brand new textbook called God's World, His Story. How many of you have used that textbook? Ah, just about every hand. God's World, His Story. Well, after 43 years, we're retiring that textbook, and we have a new one called Across the Ages, a seventh grade social studies history textbook for Western civilization. So at 10:30, I will have a class just looking at the various aspects of that textbook, either for teachers who are already teaching it, for board members who may want to look at it, or for teachers who are just interested. So at 10:30, we'll have Across the Ages introducing the new social studies textbook. I don't think I finished my biography. My wife and I have three married children, 13 grandchildren, enjoying that stage in life tremendously. We three brethren are kind of in three generations. Mark has grown children and also one grandchild, and Gary has young children at home yet, and so we fill three generations, I guess you could say. And so at this time, I'm going to ask Mark Webb from McKinney, Virginia, to come and tell us about his workshop and about him and his family. Number two workshop. Mark?
Okay, my name's Mark Webb, and I live, as Elmer mentioned, in Southern Virginia, right below Richmond. And we have, my wife and I have seven children. Our youngest two are still in school. Eighth grader and an 11th grader in school yet, and the others are, several are married, and one planning to get married in January, so kind of in that busy stage there. I taught school in and grew up around the Fort Wayne, Indiana area, and then we moved to Virginia to work at Mountain View Nursing Home. And during the time that I was there, I was also ordained to the ministry there. And after being at Mountain View for quite a number of years, I went back to the classroom again and taught school several more years. And now we moved to an outreach community where I serve as the administrator of the school. And we have just a small school, 29 students there. And I I do a Bible study once a week with the students, the upper grade students, and also meet with the teachers on a regular basis. I'll be looking this morning at this workshop on staff development, ways that you as a teacher can, some ideas of ways you can improve your skills and develop as a teacher. Also for some ideas for board members and others of how you can help encourage that development in teachers as well. So that's what we'll be covering in the staff development.
Okay, Gary, coming from Allentown, Pennsylvania, will tell us about his workshop on reading comprehension.
Good morning. A little about myself. I live at Allentown, Pennsylvania, as Elmer said. My wife and I have six children. The oldest is 11 and the youngest is 6 months. And I teach school most of the time when I'm not doing other things like this workshop trip. Work for Christian Light just a little bit and raise some vegetables in the summertime and sell those. In our workshop, on workshop number three, Do You Understand?, we want to look at reading comprehension, especially lower grade reading comprehension. Some tips, suggestions, and feel free to share your tips and suggestions and bring your questions.
Okay, at this time, I would like for you to choose the workshop that you would like to attend. And going from number 1, 2, and 3, I'd like to take a hand raise count as to how many plan to take each workshop. There's two things into consideration. One is the size of the meeting room. The other is a few of us use projectors. And so I may place you not entirely by size, but according to where the projectors are located. So starting with number 1, is there anyone interested in Across the Ages? Would you raise your hand? Okay. And number 2, staff development, would you raise your hand? Okay. And those reading comprehension, would you raise your hand? And raise them a little higher, I want to get a good count here. Okay. We're going to do it this way. Mark, I'm going to let you in here to use this projector. Number 1 is going to be in room B. So on the little line to the left of number 1, you can put a B, and that's the first room on the right going down the hall toward the school building. Number 2, we'll call that this room A for auditorium. So number 2 will be here in A, and number 3 will be in room C, which is back the hall to the left toward the food, a room on the right. And we will make sure there are adequate chairs in that classroom for reading comprehension. So I'll repeat those. Number 1 workshop will be in B, number 2 will be here in A, and number 3 will be in C. So as soon as Mark gets finished here this morning, without further ado, you can make your way to the gymnasium there for a snack. And then at 10:30, when you hear 3 bells, you go to either A, B, or C, according to your choice. We also will have a warning bell telling us when to slow down. And 1 ring, 2 rings is when our time is up. But what concerns you is when you hear 3 bells, that's when you need to go to your next location. Is there anything I'm missing? Okay, let's give Mark our attention at this time as we look at who we are. And then after the break, we'll go to workshop A, B, and C. God bless you, Mark.
Forgot to mention, I also work for Christian Light part-time, serve as a school rep for the schools in North Carolina and Southern Virginia and some in Delaware and Maryland. So kind of get around, and it's interesting to get around and visit schools and help in that way. And I also help Elmer with teacher training in the summer, a couple weeks as well, so that's enjoyable. Okay, I'd like to begin this morning's session with who are we, and I'd like to think just a little bit about the Israelites, and I'm going to read a few verses from Exodus chapter 12 in thinking about who the Israelites were. In Exodus 12, in verse 21, it says, "Then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said unto them, Draw out and take you a lamb according to your families and kill the Passover. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood that is in the basin and strike the lintel and the 2 side posts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until the morning. For the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians. And when he seeth the blood upon the lintel and on the 2 side posts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not suffer the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. And you shall observe this thing for an ordinance to thee and to thy sons forever. And it shall come to pass, when ye come into the land which the Lord will give you, according as he hath promised, that ye shall keep this service. And it shall come to pass, when your children shall say unto you, What mean ye by this service? That ye shall say, It is a sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when he smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses. And the people bowed the head in worship." Now, one of the things, as you remember, about the Passover, one of the reasons God told them that you should do this is so that when you're doing it, your children are going to say, "What's this all about?" It's going to make them ask questions. And when they ask the question, then you get to tell them the story of what happened. Now, as you look at the history of the Israelites, they had a little problem that we also have, and that is they often forgot. In fact, even keeping the Passover, after the time of Samuel, and this happened prior during the time of the judges as well, during the time of the judges, there were times where a judge would come in and it seemed like things would go all right for a while, and then they'd fall away again. Well, during the time of the kings, in 1 Kings and 2 Kings, there's only two times that the Passover is mentioned being kept. And one of those is during the time of King Hezekiah, and the other one is during the time of King Josiah. So by and large, they didn't keep it. Their children didn't ask questions on what you're doing, and they basically forgot it. And they ended up being carried away into captivity because they forgot. In one sense, you could say because they forgot God, but they also forgot their history. Today we celebrate the communion service in our churches, and Jesus said, "As often as you do this, in remembrance of me." And so when we do that, our children sometimes say, what are you doing? What's this about? Well, it's an opportunity for us to tell them what Jesus did and to tell, remind them again as well. In the book of Joshua, when Joshua crossed into the land of Canaan and they crossed the Jordan River, he had prepared, and God told him to do this, he had prepared 12 men, one from each tribe, to take stones out of the river where the priests had stood when they walked in there in the ark, and it held the water back, and they piled up these stones. And basically, God said that, okay, so in time to come, when your children say, "What's this pile of rocks about?" that you can tell them what happened. You can tell them the story of how God held the water back and they were able to walk across and come into Canaan. In the book of Numbers, the children of Israel were told to have this band of blue around the border of their garment so that every time they would see it, they would remember the commandments of the Lord. And so God knows we're forgetful. David writes in one of the Psalms, and he says, "Forget not all his benefits." Well, you probably don't remember them all, but don't forget them all either. We tend to be forgetful. And so it's important that we're thinking about who we are and where we come from. I'd like to read just a statement out of this book. I'll talk about this book in a minute. It says that we're no different from other people and that it's easy for us to forget history. When that happens, we run the risk of not only losing the coming generations, but also our distinctiveness, which is much more than just plain clothing or lifestyle. It's a set of beliefs and ideas about how to live out Christianity in the world. And it's important that we're remembering who we are, where we came from, how did we get here, also where we're going. Knowing about our past and why the choices were made and what our values are helps give us direction for the future. The better we can understand where we come from, the better we can project a path forward. Now, there's a book out called The Unserlite. Any of you familiar with that book? Okay, a few of you. It's a book written by Leroy Beachy. And he was talking about the Amish. And he gives a history starting with the Anabaptists in 1525 and kind of leading up to today and how the Amish came about. And to introduce that in the preface of that book, he has a little account of back in the 40s. He was at his at his house and as a little boy, and their parents had company for lunch. And this man, after lunch, kind of tipped back in his chair, and he said, "I often wonder where the Amish came from." And nobody, Leroy's parents didn't really say, and they had a maid there named Elsa Kaufman, and she's about 18 years old and, you know, had all the answers, I guess. And so she gave him this answer. Now, I'd like you to listen to this and see how well you know your history. She gave this answer. She said, "At one time long ago, there were only Indians in America, and since their tribes were always fighting with each other, there never came to be very many of them. At the same time in Europe, the white man had not engaged in wars, and so had become overcrowded. A meeting was held in 1492, in which it was decided to send 3 shiploads of people to America to alleviate the situation. The people chosen to leave were called pilgrims, and the ships were named Ninta, Pinta, and Santa Maria. As the ships were crossing the ocean, the captain, John Smith, had been busy preparing 3 papers, which he read to the passengers when they landed. The passengers on one ship were to be Amish, those on the second ship, conservative, those on the third ship, Mennonite. When asked where the non-Amish came in, she quickly replied that they were the ones that defected." Now, if you know your history at all, there's a lot of errors in that account. But I read it to my children, and they were like, wait, that's not right. But sometimes our history, maybe, you know, thinking about, you know, we study world history and church history, but it's also important to know our history of, you know, how did this, those of you that are from this community, how did you get here? Well, you know, I think from the little I heard the other night, a lot of you came from Pennsylvania. But why did you come up here? It's good at your schools to maybe get some of the older men to come in and tell the history. How did you get here? Why did you come here? And maybe for them to even share stories about where, you know, so if you came from Pennsylvania, how did you end up in Pennsylvania? What was the reasons? I've had the privilege of traveling a fair amount compared to some anyway, maybe. We were in Belize a couple years ago, and we went back and visited some of the areas there where in the Spanish Lookout, where the Mennonites first came to that area, I think 61 years ago. And I got to hear different people tell stories about the hardships and the other things they experienced coming in there. We also had been in Paraguay and visited a Mennonite museum where there were lots of old equipment and other things that they used in the early days. And if you think about, you know, the people that went into Paraguay there, it was essentially an area where the government thought nobody can probably even live. And it was a very difficult time. A lot of them died of typhoid fever and other things because they didn't have water. But today, both in Belize and in Paraguay, they supply much of the country with dairy products and have businesses and other things. But you look at those early days when they went there, why were they going there? Well, you can sometimes talk about if you had grandparents that lived during the Depression in this country, you'll hear their stories of how difficult it was. And sometimes we can kind of focus on that and forget what was the reason these people were going to Paraguay. A lot of it had to do with religious freedom, exemption from military service, the chance to practice their belief without hindrance. And, you know, there were a lot of German immigrants that from Germany, Canada, Russia, other countries that settled there. But we can sometimes focus on maybe just how hard the pioneering days were, and forget really what was the reason for it. What was the reason for that kind of move? The Israelites in the desert had this problem. You know, they started wishing that they could have some of the food, the good food that they had back in Egypt, and they completely forgot about they were slaves there too. And it's important that we think about where we've come from and also where we're going. You know, sometimes we can focus when you go through a really hard time of trying to get established in a new community or a new country. Those people work really, really hard. What happens to the next generation? Things are kind of handed to them a little more. And they, just like the children of Israel, we're no different. We forget what this is all about. Suddenly, you know, the things that we have, we kind of benefited from our parents or grandparents, and we forget why they came here. I'd like to think just a little bit of the importance of us telling stories with especially the emphasis on our values. How many of you use the Changing Frontiers textbook? Okay, a couple of you use it. That's a study of the United States history. Now, one of the things that I appreciate about that book, there's a lot of other United States history books out there, but a lot of them emphasize God and country. The Changing Frontiers does not do that. The other thing is there's a lot of stories about things about United States history that have kind of been handed down that really cannot be documented. And the Changing Frontiers is very careful to say if this is something that can be documented or something that cannot. In the seventh grade textbook, which Elmer is going to be talking about some later, Across the Ages, there's a chapter in that book as well that talks about the Anabaptists and how they started and why, and gives you some history of one of the chapters in there, which is of value. Another book that I think is important for us to be looking at in our schools is The Martyr's Mirror. And I noticed that the school here has it in their bookshelf in the hallway. I've taught that book in our school and also in our youth Sunday school class. But that book was written because in Holland at that time, the author felt like the people were forgetting their history and what they stood for, and that's the reason the book was compiled. The Martyr's Mirror was printed here in Effort of Pennsylvania during the time of the Revolutionary War, because the churches were thinking and realizing that there were men that were getting caught up in all the excitement of the Revolutionary War and actually enlisting, and the book was printed there to help remind people of our history. And I think it's important that we continue to study that history. Now, as far as I know, neither of my parents have any Mennonite or Anabaptist background. I was a boy when about ready to start school when my parents joined the Mennonite church. Now, I can read the Martyr's Mirror, and I can feel very much a part of that because I have adapted those values. Maybe a little bit like if you read the story of Ruth when she went back with her mother-in-law Naomi, and she went back to the land of Israel and she said, your God's going to be my God and your people my people. I've adapted that as well, and so I can connect with what they are standing for in the Martyr's Mirror as well. In fact, I've noticed that sometimes people coming in to our Mennonite churches understand in some ways maybe our values better than what we do that have grown up with it. And I think one reason for that is they've often researched and studied our history. And I just want to, if you don't remember anything else about what we talked about today, I want you to remember that studying the history and communicating that is very, very important. And I want to encourage you to keep doing that. Now, church history, sometimes it's kind of messy too. There's been a lot of church splits and other things that have happened. But one thing you have to think about is that it's important to even talk about that. The Bible doesn't just tell us all the good things. It tells us the difficulties that people had as well. And it shows that to us. When my children were small and I would put them to bed at night, they liked to hear stories about when I was their age. Now, they didn't always ask for the good stories. More likely, they wanted to know some story when I got in trouble or when I got a spanking at school or other things. Why is that? Okay, so we don't want to avoid just, we need to, when we talk about history, we tell all the history. Now, there's a sense of where you, stories like that, you tell with an attitude of shame, not boasting about it. But it still needs to be told. Another book that has come out, and you'll hear about this a little bit later, Keith Kreider has written a book about church history, Resurrection to Reformation. And they're coming out with a study guide as well to use that with that book. And Keith is also working on another book coming from the Reformation up to closer to the present day as well. One of the things that it's important when you look at those kind of histories is that throughout history there's been the church as an institution sometimes, but there's always been those who also are following God faithfully, walking in the ways of God. And Keith covers that much like the Martyr's Mirror does, kind of showing the institution, also showing those who are faithfully serving God throughout history. We used a book in our youth Sunday school class, which is basically covers the same time frame that for the Keith's book does. This one's called Cathedrals, Castles, and Caves by Marcus Yoder. And he also is working on a book from the Reformation up to closer to the present time as well. This book is a little for maybe younger students. It's probably half the content in it, but covers the same time frame. So is a helpful study as well. The main reason we guard the curriculum we use in school is for the wrong value that a lot of curriculum teach, things that are contrary to our values. And I just want to also encourage you, there's a lot of books out there, devotional books. A lot more people are going to online devotionals that they get from various people. And I want you to really think about where those are coming from, if you use any of those. Because a lot of those people don't have the same values we do. And you can get a lot of, be led astray with some of that. And we need to guard our devotional input as well. A few things that I'd like to just highlight when we think about our values. One of those is amendment of life. You know, we believe that when a person becomes a Christian, that's going to affect their life. There are some people that it's more you pray a prayer. It really doesn't. Yeah, they encourage you to live right, but there's really not the change that of discipleship and that we're following God in every area of life. The two kingdom concept, you know, we're ambassadors here. We're not a part of this world and its kingdom. Non-resistance, simplicity, the mutual aid. Sometimes we think of mutual aid as being more somebody's barn burns and everybody goes and helps them. Well, no, there's lots of areas of mutual aid of just, you know, we live in a land where there's a lot of independent living. Everybody just kind of does their own thing and you don't get involved. And in our churches, we have accountability to each other. We have a mutual working together, and we don't want to lose that. It's important that we're teaching our history in that area. I'd like to close with a few verses from Hebrew, from the book of Peter, in thinking about who are we and where did we come from. Peter writes in chapter 2 of 1 Peter, and he says, "But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who called you," and this here he tells us where we came from, "out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." And again, who are we? "Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation." As you think about who we are and what we're trying to recognize, where we've come from, looking at our history, here he talks about us being a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, strangers and pilgrims. That's a little different concept than you hear in general society. And it's important that we're remembering that as we live our lives. Also thinking about where we're going, it's written of Abraham that it says that he looked for a city that had foundation, whose builder and maker is God. And that should also be our example. You know, Abraham was there in the land of Canaan for years, and the only place that he actually purchased was a burying place for Sarah. And as we think about our lives, we don't want to get caught up with the things that are here in this life, but be looking forward to what God has prepared for us in the future. So again, I just encourage you to study your history and be faithful in teaching that to the students so that we don't forget who we are and where we came from. We're going to dismiss you for break at this time and go to your workshop then after break.
We're going to have a breakout session again, so I'm going to leave Mark describe workshop number 4, and then Gary workshop number 5.
Okay, we'll be talking and leading problems of classroom discussions. I know this varies a little bit with your ages. A lot of times students will want to talk, but a lot of times it's not always real profitable. And how to kind of get some direction to that and get people involved and really make it to profitable.
Gary?
In workshop number 5, we're going to look at how do I challenge the underachiever, the one that just can hardly obtain. Questions and also bring your advice to the workshop. And also, how can we challenge the gifted? The ones that we think are gifted in our classrooms, are they doing their utmost, or what can we challenge them with? Are they not having a boring life because they're gifted?
And in workshop number 6, a brief history of the Muslim immigrants and population, their world, but mainly looking at how we can connect with them. Now, I'd like a raise of hands. How many of you plan to be in these different workshops so we can distribute them again? So all of you who would like to take the classroom discussion, would you raise your hand? Raise them high. Okay. Number 5, challenging the gifted, stimulating the underachiever. Raise your hand. Okay, I don't think I'll count those. And how many history of the Muslim world? Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to have number four in room C, number five here in room A, and number six in room B. Okay? Classroom discussions in C, challenging the gifted here in A, and history of the Muslim world in room B. Now, we're making a slight schedule change this afternoon. It's a small group, and what we're going to do is cut the break to 30 minutes instead of 45. Then those who have some travel to do can get an earlier start. So we're going to come to the workshops at 3:30 to 4:10 rather than 3:45, and I'll give the bell times to Justin to take care of. And so everything will be finished at 4:45, and I understand they're having a supper that can either be eaten here or take it to go. So that should help you plan your afternoon accordingly. Okay? God bless you, Gary.
Handouts coming out to you. Who is my neighbor? Do you know who your neighbor is? Yes, you. Do I know who my neighbor is? If you and I are going to challenge students and children in our lives to know who their neighbor is, and then not only know who the neighbor is, but be willing to help them, we today need to know who our neighbor is, and we need to be a good neighbor. Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan, or the story of the Samaritan who was good. I am sure that there were Samaritans that weren't good, but as Jesus told that story, there was that man that was robbed and left laying for dead along the roadside. How many of us are like priest, who if we see somebody in trouble over there, we go whizzing past because we are way too busy? You might be late for school or running behind. You might have got up too late, or maybe somebody gave you a phone call. Or maybe you're in a hurry to get home. It's been a hectic day and you're so ready to relax. You don't want to help one more person. Or maybe you're like the Levite, who you slow down and you look, but you say, I really have a lot of things to do and I just don't know how to change tires. Or are you like the Samaritan? How many of you on the way to school would see somebody that needs help and stop, call the school principal and say, I'm not going to be there for a while because I have to take this person to the hospital? What do you think the Samaritan was doing anyway? Do you think he just had a leisure day ahead? I doubt it. But Jesus got done with his story, and he said to the lawyer, he said, which now of these three thinkest thou was neighbor unto him that fell among thieves? And he said, he that showed mercy unto him. And Jesus said, go and do thou likewise. So Jesus' instructions to us is to be a good neighbor. Now, if we're going to be a good neighbor, we need to discover who that neighbor is and teach our students who that neighbor is. There's a quote there, to love our neighbor, we must care about him and know about him. Studying the otherness of other places and people helps us understand ourselves better. We have an old gentleman at our church, and he struggles with a lot of things. And so often when we see people that struggle with issues in life, it's easy for us to write them off. One thing he struggles with is telling the truth. How do you deal with people that struggle with telling the truth? Well, if you start to understand what kind of people they are, sometimes it helps us to maybe give them grace. Not so long ago, he was telling me about his childhood. And I knew snatches of his childhood, but I didn't know as much as he told me. As a young boy, 80 years ago, his parents separated. 80-some years ago, his parents separated, and his mother left him with his stepfather. And then his stepfather got remarried. So now he's being raised by two people that really aren't his parents. How do step-parents take care of a child that's not really theirs? Well, they loved him for a while, but it wasn't long and they didn't treat him well. And then they decided they couldn't take care of him, so they shipped him off to the grandmother. But she wasn't a real grandmother, she was just a step-grandmother. And then there were times when she couldn't handle him, so she shipped him off to other places. And then he ended up in the orphanage. And from the orphanage, families, 70 years ago, would get foster children, but not to love them and care for them. They would get them to do work on the farm. So if you needed a worker for your farm, you just go and get a child out of the orphanage and put them to work for the summer. And of course, you know what kind of love you would get if you're the worker rather than the foster child. It's a nice amount of free labor. And I'm sure if you didn't work up to where the foster parent wanted you to, in those days, they probably mistreated you. The end of the summer came, cold came, and back to the orphanage he would go. And so through life, he has learned to fend for himself. And part of that is telling wild and woolly stories. He said, I could tell anyone that I went to college and they believed me. He said, I never went to college, but he said, most people that I've talked to in my life, I said, yes, I went to this college and that college. He said, it made me look good. Now, do you understand a little bit what kind of person he is? And understanding people sometimes begins as we take time with them. You know, if I would always be busy, that sounds like I'm not, if I would always be busy about my own business, instead of taking time for other people, I'd never have heard his story. We must take time to listen to others. And we have people that can come to our churches, and we need to learn how to sometimes overlook them or their idiosyncrasies. We had a lady that came to our church for a while. The reason she doesn't now is because she moved out of state. But she would come occasionally, and sometimes you don't know how to help people. But there was the one day that she brought her sandwich along to Bible study. The sandwich is what was in her purse. But as we sat there in Bible study, she got up, went over to the microwave in the church basement where we were having the Bible study, heated up the sandwich, came back and sat at the table and ate it in front of the whole group of people that were having Bible study. You know, for adults, sometimes we can maybe cover our feelings, but how about children in the mixture? How would your children do if a lady came to your Bible study and sat there during Bible study and ate a sandwich? One day a man came in the door, and most of us couldn't see the doorway, but we heard his voice, we knew him. The door went open, and there was a string of strange language at the door. Later, we found out that he was telling the dog to stay outside. There was no dog out there, I'm positive. But he was talking to a dog who was not. And then he came in and gave a string of language to us in one language, and then he looked at us and he said, or did you want that in French? He had spoken it in Russian, and then he wanted to know if we wanted it in French, and he gave us a greeting in French. And the Bible study has already begun. And then he sat down and made some more exclamations. And when you have 20 children sitting around in the Bible study as well, and they begin to grin and smile, and then you have adults in the mixture who can hardly contain their smiles, you know, how do you treat your neighbor? Now, I don't know that he got upset at us, but that evening it was quite hard to smother smiles. but they are our neighbors. And when God brings people into our lives, we need to learn to maybe overlook some things. One morning we had a lady come into church to visit our church, and she brought her dog along in a baby carriage. It was a pink baby carriage with a pink tent on the top. The dog was inside with a zipper, but the lady sat by the middle aisle with the baby carriage right beside her, and she had her hand in, petting the dog the whole service. It was her therapy dog. You know, we believe people that are blind need dogs sometimes, but what about a therapy dog? What feelings go through our mind when we think a person needs a therapy dog and take it along to church? You know, there were a couple thoughts that went through my mind that Sunday morning. How long will we have to put up with a dog in church? And then I came to lunchtime. We have lunch every Sunday after church, at church. And when it came to the lunch line, she couldn't eat anything because she was allergic to it all, except the dessert. Not so long ago, I heard a lady on the street telling another lady, not from our church, that she hadn't taken a bath for 47 days and she needed money. You might run into people like that too. They're not laying by the roadside, but they're in our communities. And I realized I knew the lady. We had met her before. That evening we came out of prison and she met us on the sidewalk. And she was crying, sobbing. What do you do with a sobbing woman on the sidewalk? She's just worn out. She can't walk a bit farther, and she needs money for food and water. She's so hungry, and she's so thirsty. She has no money, and she has nowhere to go. Well, I told her that the Salvation Army is partway across the city. Well, she's already checked with them. It's too full. And the rescue mission, she had informed me, doesn't take ladies, which I knew that. I said, well, we'll go get you some water and food. Well, she can't walk that far, and she sits down in the grass and begins to cry all the more. I said, well, that's fine. We'll walk and get you water and food. She goes, well, if you can't give me money, I don't want it after all. How do you help people like that? You know, sometimes we need to mind the Spirit of God. And I think the Spirit of God helps us in helping such neighbors. The summer, a man came along to our place. We have a produce stand. And we had a mother cat who turned feisty. But because she didn't have a rabies shot, by the way, in Pennsylvania, if you have a cat, you're supposed to have gotten it rabies shots. I didn't know this. But she turned feisty and she bit the man. She attacked him. I thought only dogs attack people, but our cat proved that cats can bite. What do you do when he has bills? Do you tell him, well, you have to watch for cats? Or do you offer to pay for the bills? And what if the bills end up being $400 from one cat? Sometimes reaching our neighbors causes us to spend some money. And then we have Jehovah's Witnesses that come to our doorstep. And what if the Jehovah's Witness is your neighbor? Each of us need to learn how to handle our neighbors, as well as teach our classroom of students what to do when they have people around them that maybe think differently than they do, or act differently than they do. What do we do? Well, it starts at a young age. So first of all, on your handout, we must discover who we are. We must teach our students to understand who they are, that they live in North America. And since they're in the United States, they are wealthy. Most of them think they live in probably poor circumstances. If I ask you how many of you think that you're rich, most of you wouldn't raise your hand.
were rich, you wouldn't want everybody to know it. And we think that Donald Trump is wealthy and we are poor. But don't raise yourself by Donald Trump. You live in a great country, even though the president thinks that it could be greater. We all live in a great country. But we need to understand that we're not the only great country in the world. There's many other great places to live in this world.
And we have to understand that 31% of the world have 97% of the world's wealth. So therefore, if you have $1 million, 97% of it would be over here. The rest of you would need to live on the other 3%. What is 3% of $1 million? Does anyone know? What is 97% of $1 million? $970,000. So this side over here has $970,000 to live on in the next year. What do you have to live on?
$30,000. So we all have $30,000. Probably not. Could you all go $970,000 and split up between you all?
But you, I'm sorry, I flipped that around. You have the 970,000. I had the wrong amount for the wrong side. You have 30,000. Is it fair? Is it fair that I just gave all your 970,000 away and gave you only 30,000? Understand that today, if you have a house, a car, cash in the bank, any of your assets in the equal $10,000, you are actually wealthy. I'm going to use some statistics from this book, This Side of the Global Wall. You probably all have seen it, or maybe you didn't. If you didn't, you should get it, or at least your school should get it, so you should talk to those in charge of buying books for the school and tell them you should get this lovely book from Christian Aid. They probably don't need to do too much proofreading to it, because it's from Christian Aid, and put it in your school library. Your students will probably be interested in the statistics in it. And Christian Light sells this book as well. This book tells us that $60 million in the United States is spent per year on pets. And I don't think that's paying for cat bites. And $40 million is on things besides pet food. Like hairbrushes and toys and bows and dog carriers, things like that. $40 million. $65 billion in North America is spent on soft drinks. If you want to save money, don't buy soft drinks. $11 billion is spent on bottled water. $40 billion is spent on lawns every year. More is spent in North America on lawns than on an acre of corn. More on an acre of lawn than an acre of corn. $5.8 billion is spent in North America on cleaning cars every year. Now, we believe in clean cars, but maybe we should sometimes let the Lord wash our cars. $10 billion is spent on romance novels, and $65 billion is spent on recreational hunting and fishing. Some more statistics that aren't in this book about North America. Did you know that North Americans drink coffee on the go? The rest of the world sits down and drinks their coffee and then goes. But North Americans go through drive-thrus or run into the gas station and get coffee to take with them. And here in the United States, we have something very strange about us that we ought to know. We're one of the only countries in the world to have single-colored currency. And in North America, we supersize everything. The rest of the world has small, medium, and large. We have large, larger, and largest. for our sizes of cups. Just talk. That was you, Alma, right? That got the little time. In France, he bought a small coffee, and it was very miniature. And it was, by the way, it was Burger King, right? It wasn't even some strange coffee brand. It was Burger King coffee. Very small cup. Now imagine if you'd go to Burger King tomorrow and get a coffee and it would be a little tiny cup. In North America, people require a ton of ice. They also give thumbs up. And they request doggy bags when they go to restaurants. In the United States, the candy bars are 41% bigger than the average candy bar size. Sodas are 52% bigger, and yogurts are 82% bigger. And in the United States, it's common to chat up with strangers, but most people start out by saying, "How's the weather?" And when they say, "How are you?" in North America, they aren't giving you an invitation to open up and talk about yourself. Americans refuse to discuss finances. Did you know that? They expect free refills. The United States is one of the only countries that offers free refills on soft drinks and coffee, except for other countries where you have American food chains, fast food chains. And the football that we have in North America is different than the rest of the world. And in North America, we insist on variety. We have blueberry and vanilla, low fat, low sodium, big, small, round, and grape. Everything is grape flavored, while nothing is grape flavored in the United Kingdom. In the United States, people advertise everything. They even advertise lawyers. Many countries in the world, it would be illegal for a lawyer to put an advertisement up. Somebody that was visiting the United States said that the rented villa that they stayed in had four fridge magnets that advertised lawyers. There were brochures laying around in the villa that advertised lawyers, and even the television commercials advertised lawyers. But there's also a couple of good things about North America. The people laugh out loud, while they don't in many countries. Those in the United States smile a lot because there are so many immigrants that we've learned to bypass some of those barriers by being the language barrier by being able to smile. And Americans stay fundamentally optimistic. One Japanese guide to American culture noted that in America you can make mistakes, fail, and it doesn't matter. It is a fundamental feeling that to sometimes be incorrect is natural anyway. So who are we? And before you think we have everything good, only 18% of North Americans attend church. While only 1% of North Americans are homeless, there's one divorce every 13 seconds. And 33% of the children in North America grow up in a home without a father. Who is our neighbor? Well, we have neighbors right at home that we need to reach out to. And while North America has 5% of the world's population, 22% of North Americans are prisoners. No, sorry. 22% of North America, of the prison population in the world, is in North America. Who is my neighbor? If you're going to know who your neighbor is, then you also need to look at them. We must discover who the rest of the world is. And we can't all go to other parts of the world. We can discover the world in our backyard. But we can't take our students to China to help them discover the other side of the world. But we can, in our daily classroom life, teach them. We can teach them beyond our classroom. You might have students that have no idea what it's like outside of your county. They might think the whole world rotates around the section around the Finger Lakes. And they might think everybody in the world has lakes that are long and you have to drive the way around them to get to the other side, or else take a sailboat across them. We need to help our students see broader than that. Read to them books. Teach them other cultures. and teach them that other people do things differently than we do. That doesn't mean they're wrong, but help them be aware. And be aware of that yourself. As you go through life, you're going to face some of those. I'm going to give you a few statistics about things in other parts of the world. You need to be careful what you give to a Chinese. If you give them a clock, it means that time is running out and that a relationship is possibly going to end. If you're in Egypt, don't ask for salt. You will insult the hostess because you are saying that the food has repulsed you. And while here in North America, we get this idea that we should always be on time, other parts of the world don't believe that. In Venezuela, it is actually normal to arrive 10 to 15 minutes late. Why, if you arrive early, you might be considered eager or greedy. In Malaysia, it's okay to be 60 minutes late. But in Morocco, it is totally okay to be 24 hours late and still be on time. If you go to the country of Norway, make sure you don't touch your food with your hands. It's totally improper. Even sandwiches, you must eat with a knife and a fork. Now, while I'm giving you some of these, understand that other people in other parts of the world do forgive Americans for not knowing, understanding. They will look at you as a tourist, but if you live there very long or if you are a missionary to them, guess what? After a while, they will hope that you are more like them. In Turkey, offering to pay for your meal is considered polite, but insisting on it will offend the person that's paying. In the Netherlands, birthday greetings are given to you, not only for you, but also when your close relatives have a birthday, they will say happy birthday to you. So if your mom has a birthday, somebody might wish you a happy birthday as well. In Austria, they have a game, a finger-pulling game. That's a mini version of tug-of-war in some parts of Austria. In Mexico, it is considered a custom to shove the birthday cake into the face of the person that's having a birthday. In Japan, the children put their hands over their belly button when there's thunder. They hold their stomach. In Russia, there's a custom of having Father Frost. No, he's not Santa Claus. He's Father Frost, and he brings gifts on New Year's Day. In the United Kingdom, there's many people that believe if you meet a magpie, it's bad luck, so you need to wish him good morning. That is when you meet a magpie when you're by yourself. So you need to say, "Morning, Mr. Magpie." And when we want to beckon someone, we might beckon by curling our finger. You need to be careful in using that in other parts of the world. In Europe, that motion means goodbye, in Southern Europe. In the Philippines and in East Asia, that is only used to beckon dogs. In Brazil, some young boys have, to prove their bravery and their strength, they plunge their arms into baskets of angry bullet ants. In Spain, they have a tomato craze. In La Tomatina, they have the biggest tomato fight that you can find. In Turkey, the people don't have cockfights, they have camel wrestling. And many spectators are delighted to watch two camels fight. You just need to stand back, because agitated camels discharge disgusting smelling saliva. That is also sticky. And if you are in the Wuling Mountains of China, and you see a young lady weeping and sobbing and blubbing, just means she's going to be getting married. They will cry for a month before they get married. So just giving you a few statistics out of this book. This is another good book by Gary Miller to have, Life in a Global Village. To think about those on the other side of the wall. Did you know that while Donald Trump believes that America is great, and probably all of you do, You know, we're only a minority of the people on this planet. Did you know that 60% of the people live in Asia? So again, if we divide this in half, they would all live in Asia. You'd have to populate the rest of the world. When you think that most of the world isn't even white, doesn't even have white skin, that is a little bit hard to picture, but it's true. Sometimes we think that we as the white people are the population of the world. And only 32% of the world are Christians. And half of those are Catholic. And only about 0.1% are Bible-believing Christians. Very few practice the Bible. 16% of this world has no clean water. 60% have no toilets. And 73% of the world has no toilet paper. Things that we take for common are not in other places of the world. But 25% of the world has no cell phones. That means 75% of the world does. Cell phones have rapidly crossed this world and wrapped around it. But that tells you that more people have cell phones than have toilet paper. 91% of the world have no personal car. 91% have no personal car. How many cars do you have? Your family, that is. More than one per family, probably, most likely. 80% of the world lives on less than $10 a day. Could you live on less than $10 a day? You say, well, I don't live in that part of the world. Only 1% of this world makes $34,000 a year. So not only must we understand our world and our place in the world and understand the other people in the world, we need to understand culture. Culture is the way people do things. Not all culture is bad, but there are sometimes bad things in culture. I read a book to my students, and I couldn't find the book before I left to get the title. But it's about a lady who is a Wycliffe Bible translator, and she went into some of her tribe over in Indonesia. And when she went in there, the people thought that she and her co-Bible translator were gods because, you know, they always ate their food out of these metal tin cans. They'd always get their food shipped in. They never ate the local food. Now, I hope that after a while they were able to cross cultures and eat the cultural food. But this young lady was very perturbed because the local tribe was burying people before they were dead. The people would get very sick, and at a certain point they decided that they were dead and they'd take them out and bury them, and they weren't dead yet. And she wanted to pull those people out of the graves. But what could she do? She needed to learn to understand culture, and there's some things, some cultural practices that are wrong, but we have to be slow at we on our own are very slow at being able to change a culture. You know, at one time India would burn the widow with her dead husband. You know, that got changed eventually, but it was no easy task because there are bad things in culture. In our church, we have a man named Peter that came to our church. Peter had attended a few times before, but he's really started attending because he's in a wheelchair and he lives down the street from our church. So we were very easy to get to. We were close to him, close to his place of abode. And so he could drive his wheelchair up the street because he's basically paralyzed, more or less most of him. But Peter didn't know anything about conservative Christians at all. All he knew about was the UCC people. And I believe he had attended a Methodist church way back when he was young, but they were full of rich, stuffy people that didn't look down his family because they were poor. But Peter came about Christmas time to our church, and our church was very plain. Why, we had the plainest church he was ever in his lifetime. And this is Christmas. This is the birthday of our Lord, and there's no decorations for the Lord's birthday. Shouldn't you decorate the church for the Lord's birthday? cross-cultural. You know, it was a totally new culture to him. He was shocked. He understood that why we didn't have Santa Claus in our Christmases, but he couldn't understand why we didn't decorate for the Lord's birthday. Well, as time went on, he began to, I think, understand. But he still had lots of questions. He never was in a church that didn't have a piano in the front. Why, his mother was an organist for years in the church. And we didn't even have a piano in our church. And we sing strange songs. We don't sing anything that the UCC church sings. And our music is just kind of humdrum. We just kind of da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. And he was just about over that Christmas stuff when it came to Easter. And we don't have Easter bunnies or chocolate eggs at our church either for Easter. Why, how do your children learn about the resurrection and birth of Christ? And he's a very good Christian, and yet we won't serve him communion. And we don't greet him with the holy kiss. We don't even call on him to pray. Now, he can pray in prayer meeting, but he's not called on at Bible study to have a public prayer. And we don't have ask him to have devotionals. And then we have the strange belief we don't have televisions in our homes. And he asks, how do your children learn? If they don't have a television, if they don't have Sesame Street, how do they learn to count? You know, to us, it's one of the things we do. We just teach our children to count. We don't need Sesame Street to learn to count. But we have people like that. And cultures can be crossed, but sometimes it takes time. How much time are we willing to spend with people like Peter? Or beside the bedside of someone who is an invalid and who thinks they have too many sins, God won't forgive them. Fourthly, this afternoon, we must understand our place in the world. God has placed us in this country with opportunities. And I was also going to mention this book, The Other Side of the Wall, also by Gary Miller. Probably not so much for your students. Maybe your older students could read it. But for you and I to read a book like this and be challenged, what can we do? You know, we have opportunity. We have money. Maybe not we ourselves, but as a collective group of God's people, what can we do? Well, it takes $60 million to take care of pets in the United States, and a lot of other money is wasted. It only would take $10 billion to give this whole world clean drinking water. It would take $26 billion to educate every child in this world. It would take $11 billion to provide Bibles, and yet Americans waste their money. And lastly, the last point, we need to learn ourselves, but we must also teach our students how to be neighbors. Teach your students the story of the Good Samaritan. And challenge them, who is their neighbor? And they might be thinking, going to Iraq would be being a Good Samaritan. But you know, they can be a Good Samaritan on the street that the school is on. Secondly, show students their position in the world. I had some students that didn't even know what the local town was called. And I had other students that didn't, when they needed to fill in a map, they put the Great Lakes underneath the United States. And they might put the Gulf of Mexico up where the Great Lakes belong. Help students to picture where they are in the world. Help them to see the little picture and see the big picture, and this is the world, and this is the country we live in. Help them to understand their own culture. Just because not everyone in the world eats the same thing you do, it's okay. I had a co-teacher that is now teaching in Cambodia. So the other week she had on her Cambodia stories the pictures of rats. Did you know they eat rats in Cambodia? The The men went and killed 40 rats, and they ate some for Sunday lunch. And then she went rat hunting as well. And so I showed those pictures to my students, made sure that they knew that it's okay to eat rats, especially in other parts of the country. But how about when our students eat at home? You know, teachers can be, sometimes children can argue at home, but you know, at school, if you offer something for them to eat, they'll probably taste it because their peers are tasting it. Last year, for a prize, I took my students to the Mexican restaurant right up the street. And unbeknownst to us, some of the students ordered something that they didn't know they were ordering. Out came the platters that two of the boys ordered, and they had big cactus leaves on them. So we ate cactus. We shared the cactus, and everyone got to try cactus. And they decided that, most of them decided they didn't really like it, but they weren't too bad. They tasted like a mix between green beans and green peppers. So, if you need something to challenge your students with, take some cactuses, cooked cactuses, to school. So that someday they may be able to try other things. Help students to understand other people and their cultures as you teach them in their school lessons. Help them to know things about housings and architecture, family living patterns, clothing styles, the food people eat, their livelihood, how much money people in other parts of the world have to spend. Fifthly, teach students that God's creation is beautiful the world round, not just in New York and Pennsylvania. Teach them to avoid racism. Teach them that of one blood, all nations of this world were created. Teach them another language, even just pieces of it. You know, if you teach your students five ways to say hello in other languages, they will really enjoy that. And it will go a long way in helping them to be neighborly. Teach them to eat other foods. I already said that. Read about other cultures. Read missionary stories. Teach them to be neighborly right around you. Ask them what you could do for the neighbors or maybe the elderly in the church. Subscribe to mission newsletters. Teach a foreign song. Be on the lookout for things that you can take back to your classroom. Maybe you see some chopsticks. Maybe you take chopsticks in and give them each a set of chopsticks. Look for wooden shoes. Things that you might be able to pick up cheap. Maybe you have a friend that goes to a foreign country. Tell them to bring something. Ask them to bring something back for your classroom and pay them for that. You'd be surprised you can spend just a little bit of money for a whole lot of stuff from another country. And teach students to see a world that needs the gospel. I'm going to read you a story in closing. I read this book to my students every so many years. It's a story full of letters written by a missionary. And what happens in the story is they came home because of World War II, and they're returning to India. We stayed in Cairo for a week, rode on camels and went up inside the largest pyramid. JT, that is her husband, and I took turns going sightseeing and staying with the children, for it is too hot to drag them around any more than necessary. Cairo is a very interesting place, and I'd have liked to stay longer. They have wonderful ice cream sundaes too. What a trip it was from Cairo here to Port Said. We came by a train, half the boatload of people, and there were about 200 people too many for the train. There were seven of us jammed into a small compartment meant for four, and it was very hot. Even in October, Cairo is sizzling. And we were all wishing for a cool ocean breeze. The children had hardly anything on because they were full of prickly heat rash. We stopped at the small station a few miles from Cairo, and a large group of Mohammedan women, that is Muslim women, tried to get into our compartment. They all wore those long white robes which covered them completely except for two peepholes. They wanted to come into our compartment, but we were already so crowded we couldn't move. So we yelled through the door at them to go someplace else. Of course, they didn't understand us and kept trying to get in. One missionary lady who was sitting by the door had very big feet, and she kept one propped against the lock of the door. Suddenly, the Mohammedan women, as if at a given signal, all turned and ran away. And we were looking at each other, and we looked at each other and laughed and teased the lady by the door, telling her it was the size of her foot they were afraid of. Then an Egyptian man came and tried to get in. The lady kept her foot against the lock, and we all yelled, "Go away! There are enough people in here already," and we waved our arms and gestures, telling him to scram. The Egyptian kept banging on the door and yelled something at us in his own language, which we didn't understand. And he tried to force open the door, but the big foot did not budge. Seeing that it was useless to argue with us, he turned and ran down the station platform, tearing his hair and talking loudly to himself. Then we heard someone else pounding down the platform, and we looked to see the American Express man, who spoke English and who was in charge of our traveling party, beating his fists against the door and shouting, "Hurry up and get out of this compartment! It's on fire and blazing underneath." Thank you. Who is your neighbor? Make sure to teach the oncoming generation who their neighbor is and how they can best be good neighbors.
As I mentioned, we're going to have a forum, and I'd like the forum to be interactive as much as we can. So think about some of the things that relate to digital technology, but maybe just a few comments as to technology itself. Remember, technology is not necessarily just the things within the last generation, but technology is a lot older than that. When the wheel was invented, it was technology. About 400 years before Christ, there was a teacher who was very concerned about new technology coming into the schools, and we are too. He was very concerned about what it would do to the thinking of the students. Now, that new technology was writing. The teacher was Socrates. His student was Plato. Now, I give that not to justify the situation we're in today, but just to get us to think about technology from various perspectives. And so as we think about the influence of technology on our students, there is good and there is bad. There are right ways, there are wrong ways in which we can use technology. The assignment given to us by the committee is that we would divide this topic into three parts. We would look at the effects of technology on the mind and the brain. We would look at the effects of social media. And we would look at the attention span issues, distraction, lack of focus, wandering around in the brain. Now, we're using some technology here. Some of you are writing. And what Socrates had in mind is going from an oral tradition to a written tradition brought changes into the way people memorized things. So there's not nearly as much memorized today as there was before or even during the time of Christ. Did you ever wonder how Matthew and Peter and Luke, some of the early writers of the Gospels, how they wrote down so much of what Jesus taught. They didn't have recorders. I don't think they were even taking notes, although writing was prevalent at that time. But I think they still had an oral memory, speaking and memorizing, and then were able to write it down for later generations. I'm going to read two quotes by a Jim Taylor. He said, "There is little doubt that all of the new technologies are shaping the way we think in ways that are obvious and yet subtle, deliberate and unintentional, advantageous and yet detrimental. The uncertain reality is that with this new technological frontier in its infancy and developments emerging at a rapid pace, we have neither the benefit of historical hindsight nor the time to ponder or examine the value and cost of these advancements in terms of how it influences our children's ability to think." Further, he wrote, "The internet was invented and children were thrust into a vastly different environment in which, because distraction is now the norm, consistent attention is impossible, imagination is unnecessary, and the memory is inhibited." Now, it used to be, and we still have that in school policies, that we did not take children into our schools where television was used in the home. But today, while we may not have television in the home, more and more of our communities have other devices that can be just as detrimental. So those are some of the things that we're looking at here. Now, as we think of the brain itself, I'm made to think of a word called neuroplasticity. Now, you may not like this, but did you know your brain is plastic? Well, not the material that we call plastic. But plastic, by definition, simply means moldable, shapeable, changeable. The capacity for continuous alteration of the neural pathways and synapses of the living brain and nervous system in response to injury, experience, or injury. It operates in the same way as an addiction to cocaine. There's a man in Stuart Straff, Virginia, by the name of Brad Huddleston, has written a book called Digital Cocaine. And in his research, and he travels all over the world, from South Africa to Australia to Europe, U.S. and Canada, speaking to high schools about the dangers of digital addiction. And there's two words I'd like to look at here. One is the word dopamine, and the other is the word serotonin. These are chemicals that I understand work in our brain. And while I don't understand it, I'd like to just take their research for what it's worth and share some of that with us here this afternoon. And I have this illustration that I'm going to share. When we think of dopamine, we're looking at the left side here, and that is a picture of the brain, and maybe all you can see is the arrows, but you have the shape of the brain there. And I think you can read this side. It wasn't the best graphic. But the dopamine is what brings pleasure. But I'd like for us to see the difference between pleasure and happiness. Now, it's a type of addiction, whether it's cocaine or whether it's dopamine, that the more you get, the next time you have to have more to get the same level of experience. And then the next time, more and more and more. It's like there's a wall going up here in your frontal lobe that is keeping the good sensory networks at bay. So looking at this again, it is addictive. It is very short term. It inspires taking rather than giving. It's very selfish. There's so much in the digital world today that is all about me. taking selfies, taking whatever. It's typically experienced alone, and it makes the brain say, this feels good, I want more, and too much dopamine leads to addiction. On the other side, serotonin brings happiness, and it's not addictive. It brings long-term contentment, so we want more serotonin. It's felt above the neck rather than in the whole body, and it inspires giving. It is generally shared, and it makes the brain say, this feels good, and it's enough. And too little of it leads to depression. So, balancing this out, we want more serotonin and less dopamine, lest we fall into depression. There's so much that is happening in today's world because of some of those advancements in technology and the amount of time that people are actually spending in some of those things. Now, our format is going to be, I'm going to end it with then some question and answers, anything in general. Mark's going to talk about the media, the social media, and its effects upon us. I've asked him to then open up for question and answers, and then Gary is going to talk about the attention deficit. And we'd like to hear from you. What are you doing in your school? What are you seeing? What are some solutions? What are some things we should be doing on the school level? Mark?
We think about relationships, and we talked about that in our one workshop. God has designed us to want relationship. And one of the things that is happening with the social media, in doing some research on this, I discovered that a lot of folks that are older that use social media are using it kind of as a way to connect with maybe old friends or kind of hear a little bit what's happening, and doesn't have a huge amount of effect other than sometimes they'll get caught up in wasting time on it. But for younger people, it has caused a lot of depression and even suicides, where there's an all you see is the good side of people, and the expectations of trying to meet up to that what other people are putting on their Facebook page and other things has driven a lot of people to do really unreasonable things sometimes. I'm curious a little bit here, and maybe this is a bad question, but how many of you use some type of social media? Number of you do. One of the this was a term that was coined, I think, in 2004, FOMO, a fear of missing out, and it's something that's come about because of the social media. There's all these exciting things that everybody's doing, and every time your phone beeps or vibrates or whatever, you've got to know something happened, and you've got to know what it is. And there's a drive to find out. And I read of this girl that was killed in an accident, and they checked her phone, and for the last, I forget, it was over 24 hours anyway, it might have been the last couple days, there was never more than 15 minutes that she had not either received or sent some kind of message or something with her phone. That fear of missing out. Something's happened and I got to know what it is. This whole thing has driven a lot of people to the point of, yeah, they constantly have to be connected to that. And I'd like to, when you think about this, we didn't put this on our schedule because as Mennonites, we're concerned about what effects this may have. It's not just us. There are the healthcare world is very, very concerned about what the social media and things is doing to people, their relationships, their mental health, their physical health. And I'd like to share a little quote here with someone from the Global Public Health at the University of California. It says, "What we know at this point is that we have evidence that replacing your real-world relationships with social media use is detrimental to your well-being. The use of social network has negatively associated with factors including physical health, mental health, and life satisfaction. Offline interactions, meantime, has had positive effects." And she went on to say this, "Where we want to be cautious is when the sound of a voice or a cup of coffee with a friend is replaced with likes on a post." And I think as you think about that, you know, some people are so driven to, I've got to show this picture or do something, then I got to know how many likes we got on this, and versus taking time and sitting down and just interacting with somebody one-on-one. How many of you have been to a restaurant and seen people there on the phone? Okay? So they're there together, and yet they're not together. They're not really communicating with each other. I find it interesting that there are restaurants and there's a lot of resorts now that are advertising you pay extra, and people are doing it. One place, it's $200 a night to stay at this place, and it's entirely, there is no service whatsoever. And they had 300 people on the waiting list. Now, why would you pay extra to go someplace where your phone doesn't work? Why not just turn it off? But that's kind of where this is at. As you think about, you know, having relationships with one another, or just having kind of superficial relationships on thing, how many friends do I have on Facebook or other types of social media? What questions do you have, or what does this bring to your mind? How many of your students have phones? Okay, a few of them. A lot of you don't have high school students there. How many of you teachers have phones in your classrooms? Okay, most of you. Any problems with that, or does that work out all right? Nobody brave enough to say. It's one of those detox places, huh? Yeah. Yeah, people are, according to what I've researched, there are people that are paying extra for that. Any other comments about that? Well, we've been asking this question at different workshops, and there's a number of the schools that we've come across that they do not actually allow their teachers even to have them in the classroom. They're kept in the office. Now, obviously, if you don't have service, that doesn't do you a whole lot. Because a lot of times when people get bored or other things, or just or if it beeps, they got to know what's happening, and maybe you're trying to teach a class or do, you know, and if you're constantly interrupted with that. Any other comments about that or what you're doing that to answer his question? Yes. I found it interesting. I took a food serve manager's course here at a local college, and I was surprised at how hard they went about making sure that we had no electronic gadgets with us when we took that test. And I mean, they emphasized it that, hey, look, if you've already paid for this course, and if you have any kind of device like that, you don't get any diploma, and your money's just out. You've got to start over. I was surprised that, I mean, no notes. You couldn't take anything into the test, and I thought it was kind of interesting how much they emphasized it, and maybe how careless we are sometimes when somebody takes a test. But I remember reading of this grandma that at Thanksgiving time, she set a basket by the door, and she had all her family, as they came for the Thanksgiving gathering, to put all their electronic gadgets in this basket so that they would interact with each other and throughout the day. I think there's some of those kind of things that we miss out on in just interacting with each other because of having some of this technology. Not that it's all wrong and that we can use it for good things, but there's a place and to use it, and there's a time and place not to use it, and helping each other with that. One boundary that I found online too that was said that it's not a good idea to take a phone, for couples to take phones on a date. Or having phones in your bedroom or places like that, leave them somewhere else. So that you can give your full attention to the others that you're with and not be distracted by a phone. Any other comments about our relationships and social media?
Are your students distracted by technology? Have their attention spans changed since yours, when you were in school? If they have, why? Has technology really changed them? I ask you to think about yourself. If you are reading your Bible, yourself, and you have a piece of technology laying, I don't have my technology here. If your technology is laying here and you're reading here, and it goes beep, what's your tendency to want to do? Mine is on vibrate 99.9% of the time, because I don't want it to be a distraction. But you know, if it's laying on a hard surface and I'm reading my Bible beside it, guess what? That thing vibrates and I hear it. It's very easy to for your mind to wonder, well, okay, so I decide to avoid it. But my mind still thinks about that piece of technology. I wonder who messaged me. If you have children in your home, and you have WhatsApp, you will find out that children like to see WhatsApp status very often. We have some children in our home that every evening think they need to see WhatsApp status. And you know, they're so distracted by such things that they will spend their whole evening doing it. If you would let them, they would sit there and go over it, and they don't just stop there. Then they go to look at their parents' pictures that they've seen 25 times in the last week. They will watch the same video clip that they've seen 100 times in the last month. You know, it might only be a 5-second video clip, but they'll watch it over and over and over again. You'll hear the same cousin of theirs making the same noise over and over again. Not so long ago, well, it's about a year ago, I think, my brother-in-law and sister-in-law were going to have another child. And the child was going to be another boy. And so their girl was sobbing on the video that her mother took of her, because she doesn't want to have another boy in this family. It's going to be just horrible. And our children took such a delight in watching that piece of technology over and over again. I don't know if it's still in my wife's phone or not, but you know, children are attracted, but so are we. And distracted. And we always want something new. One day we were driving down the road from church one late evening, so it was dark. And the car right beside us at the stoplight, the lady had her smartphone, and she was flipping through. I mean, her hand was moving about like this. I don't know how she saw anything on her phone. But just that whole thing of fast technology, when we want it, getting there, what we need, has changed our attention spans. Some of you probably remember when we had to have dial-up emails, and you sat there and you waited for hours, it seemed, for those emails to come in. Maybe some of you still have dial-up, I don't know. But I know that if we had to sit there and wait for that email to come in for 15 minutes, we might be about pulling our hair out. Or else we decide the technology wasn't worth it. And technology isn't new. And even if we get rid of modern technology, there's some other technology that we need to deal with in the classroom. How many of you have erasers in your classroom? Can erasers be a distraction to your students? Why, we had a student at our school a couple weeks ago that got a new eraser in the morning, and by the afternoon, her eraser was half gone. Her eraser obviously was keeping her from getting her work done. How many of you have students that have pencils that are newer technology than the ones that they had in the beginning of the 1900s? We have these pencils that go click, 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 and then the lead comes out, and then you have to change lead, and the lead breaks. You know, those are all distractions. We need to help our students learn to deal with distractions. We're not going to get rid of them totally. There's a time when students need to learn that, put the toy aside. The toy doesn't belong here. We also need to help students learn the fact of life that there is more to the world than being distracted by technology, but that I need to be living, not being distracted. Microsoft of Canada was quoted in the Time magazine in 2015, and it said, "You now have a shorter attention span than a goldfish." Microsoft CEO said the true scarce commodity is increasingly human attention. According to the study, the average human attention span is now 8 seconds. If that's true, and you're still reading this or listening to this, congratulations, you have an exceptional mind. I hope our schools are better than the average public school, but I understand their attention spans are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And if you have dealt with any children in the public arena, you'll find that. Their attention spans are short. Sitting down and listening to an hour sermon might be boring. Why, a week and a half ago at our church, I was coming up the steps and there was a girl from the city standing there with a youth girl that had brought her to church. And the youth girl said, "Do you know what we're doing here today?" And she said, "Yes, we're going to listen to them preach." And they preach for a whole hour here. She said, "Doesn't their mind get sore after talking so long?" Another quote. "We have come to believe that the human brain is a master navigator of the river of information that rages steadily all around us. And yet we often feel challenged when we try to fulfill even fairly simple goals. This is a result of interference, both distraction from irrelevant information and interruptions by our attempts to simultaneously pursue multiple goals." Many of you may now be glancing accusingly at your mobile phone. But is it the mobile phone's problem? Or is it your brain's problem? You know, our brain can only take so much, and so we need to learn to put our attention on the things that matter. And make sure that we are learning them, as well as teaching the young ones in our care. Technology isn't the most important, but serving the Lord is. What questions do you have about attention and distractions? What would you do to help your children from being so distracted by technology? Because you live in the same world I do, and you know that children love technology. What is better than technology? Even the royalty of this world knows what's better than technology. How many of you know what the Princess of England is doing with her children? Princess Kate of England, what's she doing with her children? Yes. What's that? No, they're not homeschooled. She actually takes them to some, I don't even think it's elite school. I think they put them in, they want them to be schooled with the normal child. She actually is pushing them to get outside. Spend time outdoors. She actually has just created some woodsy type scenes. I'm not sure what all she has put into them, but, you know, trees and brooks and that kind of thing, so her children can get out there and enjoy nature, because she knows that that's more important than technology. How can you deal with technology, the distractions in the classroom, if it's in the home? He asked a question, I'll let you answer. Are any of you doing anything? Do your schools have anything implemented? What if you find out that the children were spending all evening watching a, quote, good movie? You know, you can spend all evening learning how to build a treehouse. Isn't that important? Some people would say it is. What's it do to the child's mind if they never deal with the real side of life? I don't think there's anything that we can do with the home situation. Totally. Besides, talk to the parents. And if you have your statistics, if you know that this child is struggling, really struggling in school, and if you ask the parents what they think is the problem, and if you can get them to admit that it might be technology, that goes a long way. And if they can see the point of the technology being a problem, maybe. What's that? Does he fish? Does he fish? On how to fish. And there's a time to have limits or to say we're not going to talk about it. You know, if there's one family in the school that doesn't allow watching YouTube, should the other 95% of the school talk about watching YouTube videos? It's better to say no one's going to talk about YouTube videos in our school so that that one family doesn't feel left out. And, you know, they might be watching, quote, good YouTube videos. But yet, there's a detriment to always needing to go look at YouTube videos, being distracted by them, when there are so many other important things to do. I don't know that we answered your question. Maybe you answered it for us. I agree. How much better to listen to you tell us how to go fishing or to do whatever, fix cars.
There's a school in northern Indiana on a prior trip where the administrator said that when parents sign up in their school, they sign a commitment that their children will not have more than 2 hours a week of YouTube or whatever screen time.
So, you know, the school board like you can maybe make some policies for your school. Any other questions? Okay, I'll turn it back over to Brother Elmer.
Maybe to get practical in the school, how do we communicate with parents? And I'm going to bounce off of that last statement. Face-to-face is still the best. Now, I'm an antique, but all my teaching years, I didn't have a cell phone. And so when we wanted to meet with a parent, we tried to meet personally. Telephone, I didn't even like that. You know, there's so much body language lost in that. But, and I'm not going to ask for a raise of hands, but how many of us today are, there's a problem with Johnny in school and we text a parent? Now, how is that text message interpreted without any body language? You know, it can just misconstrue the whole idea pretty quickly. I'd just like a little give and take on that. How are we communicating with parents? And what is the response? Now, if you don't have cell phone service at school, which I remember, your teachers aren't texting the parents. So they're going to the phone on the wall or a cordless, at least, something of that nature. So how do you communicate with parents? I didn't get that. Okay. Through texting, maybe you send a note, I'm not sure. But let's get as much face-to-face time as we can so that we can connect with them there. In the closing minutes here, I'd like to talk back again to the brain. And this research is not my own. It was shared with me by a friend. And I'd like to talk about the frontal lobe here, and that is this red part in our forehead, and again, that wall that goes up. But this frontal lobe is designed by God, so brain surgeons say, and there's some very vital things, and as we have that digital cocaine just raising that blockage higher and higher, these following things are not going to happen. For example, the frontal lobe is essential for building social relationships. People are so withdrawn today and not building social relationships. The love of nature, perceiving what's going on around, not getting outside to play, learning and developing math, reading and music, and understanding the consequence of our own actions and having the capacity to project future implications. You know, so much today you hear of people who do those terrible things. Maybe it's a shooting or something, and are not weighing ahead. They're not able to anymore to understand that if I do this, this will be the result. And I believe this is planned by Satan because it inhibits the discerning of good from evil. And it's a way of dulling the conscience so that anything goes. It's also necessary to prevent antisocial and deviant behavior, making and analyzing things whether they are right or wrong, memorizing and analyzing the past in order to correctly define one's own identity. So think about it. Satan must be rejoicing with what technology has done to the brain in desensitizing the human mind and the capacity to communicate with God. We talked about restrictions, whether we limit it for a few hours a week. And I've been using a parallel that I'd like to share with you now. How many of you are concerned about the amount of sugar coming in the lunches? Any of you teachers worried about sugar? Well, they put all that sugar in the lunches. We have parents sitting here too. And then at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we go and scrape them off the wall. They're that hyper. Well, I've suggested for years that at a parent-teacher meeting that someone help our parents to see what sugar does in the lunches, to the children. And I think the same thing needs to be done with this type of thing. Maybe draw a comparison that just like sugar makes it very difficult for our children to learn, even so your screen time that you're doing at home is doing the same thing and making it very, very difficult for us as teachers in what's going on in the home. The name Steve Jobs and Bill Gates are not new to us. Mr. Jobs is no longer living, but Bill Gates still is. And I'm sure since this statistic was written that their children have grown up quite a bit. But here we have some of the people who are instrumental in the smartphone, for example, and in modern technology. But they have sheltered their own children. They have sent their children to schools that do not have computers. That seems a bit, you decide. Here are some of the rules that they use. No phone until the children turn 14, and I think I would jack that a lot higher. Banning devices at family dinner. That's not so foreign. We can do that. Banning devices at family dinner. Even if it's something as simple as a phone, doesn't have to be a smartphone. A flip phone should be banned from family dinner as well. Setting a curfew for children to be off devices well before bedtime. Setting strict limits on screen time. This is coming now from these men during the school week, or even banning screens entirely for younger children. The last parentheses was mine when I shared this with our congregation at home. I said, your school teachers will appreciate this. Carefully considering what social media services to allow your children to use, and banning devices in children's bedrooms. Have the charging cord on the kitchen counter, someplace like that, rather than in children's bedrooms. We can make a difference, and I would encourage us to be very vigilant and do what we can to make a difference. I'd like to introduce a book yet, if you have an opportunity of getting this book. It's by Nicholas Carr, entitled The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. In short, I will give you his testimony. Nicholas Carr, when he wrote that book, went out to Colorado in a place where there was very little internet and media, and he tried to write that book, but his brain would only function for short periods of time. And so the longer he stayed in that remote area, his brain started freeing up. And after a while, he could spend hours writing this book without needing to turn to a phone and things that were distracting him. We are being distracted. We need to admit that. But what are we doing in our schools and in our homes that would help that? Okay, I'm going to dismiss you for a break. A few reminders that I haven't made recently and in your evaluations as you leave. We've been talking about who we are. Then after lunch, we talked about who is my neighbor and reaching out into other cultures. We're going to now kind of pull that together. We've had different topics relating to these aspects. And so for this one, we're going to look at how we connect with others. And I'm going to start by looking at the Statue of Liberty. The Statue of Liberty stands for freedom. And it also stands for a coming together of other cultures. And so at that point, the United States was taking in a lot of immigrants. People were coming from all over Europe, coming to America for freedom. And this statue, if I remember its history, was donated to the United States by France. And at the base of that statue is a plaque. And on that plaque is a poem called The New Colossus. And I'm going to read just the closing words of that poem. And it goes like this. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Brother Gary gave us a lot of statistics and percentages, and I'm going to share some others as well. So here in 2019, almost 2020, we're standing, as it were, on the threshold, and we're looking ahead. And if we allow it to, the world can look very dark and foreboding. Homelessness is on the increase in 2018, with statistics reporting over 550,000 people in the United States without a home, and the average age of the homeless being about 9 to 11 years old without a home. In addition, many of these are struggling to get their next meal. There's a lot of rhetoric concerning illegal aliens coming in the southern borders. And I just wonder, if I may, if our President Trump has read the plaque at the base of the Statue of Liberty recently. Send me your homeless, your tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Now, I don't want to wax political here, but we tend, if we're not careful, to agree with the prevailing wind that goes around. And if we're not careful as believers, we also then wonder about these refugees and take up positions against them. Racism and white supremacy have reared their ugly heads in recent years with with a return to conversations, including the Ku Klux Klan and Nazism and other of those evils. And I almost fear to think of what the 2020 elections might bring out with all the mudslinging and things that have been going on to date. And then on the front, foreign front, we have Hong Kong, we have Paris, we have the trade wars with China and Japan, and with our neighbors, Mexico and Canada. We have nuclear treaties broken with Iran, with North Korea, and with Russia. And the continued needs in the Middle East, just the recent scrimmages there on the Turkish border, where the Turkish forces were fighting into Syria, and reports of killing of Kurds as a form of ethnic cleansing. Now, I realize we cannot trust what we read in the newspapers and media, and yet I believe there's something very real happening out there and these people are like wanting a better life and wanting to come in to America and Canada and other countries. So how do we fit into this, and how can we connect with them? From the brochure that you have, the program booklet, this is what it said about this last 30 minutes. It said, we have all one Father and Creator. In a real sense, we are brothers and sisters with everyone else in the world. What we understand about others and how we think about them will influence our connections with them. How can we avoid the extremes of a superior spirit toward others or the need to become as those of another society so that we do connect? As I investigate this, it boils down to these two statements. We all have one Father and Creator, and that makes us brothers and sisters with everyone else in the world. The immigrants, the ones on welfare, the druggies, the drunkards, they're our brothers and sisters. We've heard repeatedly about the Good Samaritan. I turn to Scripture now in Acts chapter 17. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. Let me interrupt there. Acts 17 is the account where Paul came to Athens. And there on Mars Hill, he saw their idols. And then he saw one idol, one monument that was marked to the unknown God. And it seemed that they were so zealous to make sure they worshiped all the gods that they had one there that was unnamed. And Paul said, that's easy. I can tell you who he is. He's my God. And so he goes on and he said, this God dwelleth not in temples made with hands. You can't build a temple for him. Neither is worship with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing that he giveth to all life and breath and all things. And then verse 26, and hath made of one blood all nations of men, for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. I go next right to Revelation chapter 7, starting in verse 9. After this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues or languages, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands, and cried with a loud voice, saying, salvation to our God, which sitteth upon the throne, and unto the Lamb. Now I ask ourselves the question, if we expect to be there before the throne, with all nations and people and kindreds and tongues, don't you think it'd be a good idea to practice that now? To be more ethnically diverse and to rub shoulders with other ethnic groups? But what do we really understand about others? How do we think about them that may or may not hinder our connections with them? Which brings me back then to those two crucial questions. How can we avoid having a superior spirit toward others? And what do I mean by that superior spirit? I think we've all been there, and I'll give you a bit of a scenario later to point that out. The other extreme is, how do we avoid the extreme of the common thinking that we need to become like them to win them, to call them to Jesus and to the gospel? Go with me then on an imaginary journey. It may be Romney, West Virginia, my closest town. It may be anywhere, USA, Romulus, New York, Seneca, Geneva, wherever you're from, upstate Pennsylvania. We're driving down the street, maybe on the wrong side of the tracks, as we used to say, and we encounter this man with a shopping cart. And there he is with all his meager possessions, right there in that basket. I don't know if any of you have moved from one house to another recently. Did you get everything in a shopping cart and push it along like that? I sure don't. Or we see their tents down under the bridge or along the river in these homeless gatherings. Or we're approaching our favorite restaurant and we see this woman asking for money for a sandwich. Or closer home, we have a children's ministry there in Romney, and at the end of a meeting, sometimes there are some children who don't want to go home. They have nothing secure to go home to. Home to us is a place of safety. To them, it is a wishful dream. Back to the Jericho Road. Sometimes I feel very much like the priest or the Levite rather than the Good Samaritan. So what's common in all of these scenarios? It could be said that it's a case of a superior spirit, where we tend to look down at other people. It's a case of looking at the rest of the world through a lens, a colored lens, that makes them look worse and makes me look better. I invite your attention to a man by the name of Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards lived in the 1700s, and he's more well known for his sermon that he preached entitled Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. But he also did some writing, and he wrote an essay entitled The Seven Symptoms of Spiritual Pride. And I'm going to just quickly go through those, and I'll take two of them together here, fault-finding and a harsh spirit. You know, I find that it is very possible when someone has a harsh spirit or is finding fault with others, that it may well be that that person is hiding something in their own life. Many years ago in our congregation, we had a man who it was discovered was abusing children in the congregation. But prior to that, I'd always sensed just this, a fault-finding and a harsh spirit. Sometimes we find ourselves being very superficial, which was Jonathan Edwards' third point. And by definition, that has to do with just what's on the surface. You know, we say he is a mile wide and only an inch deep. Things lying very close to the surface. We can't get very deep in a discussion with certain individuals. The next one in these situations is we become very defensive. We become defensive when we're approached about something. And then we have this presumption before God, and a presumption that we are better than others, and that they probably have very little hope of finding salvation like we have. And then we have that desperation for attention, and finally the neglecting of others. And I could spend more time on those, but I'd like to leave that and go to Acts chapter 10 and look at the account of Peter. I'm going to tell it in my own words. In Acts chapter 10, we have Peter, a very devout Jew. He had been taught in the law from childhood. And now as a man, he was living out what I'm going to call the perfect Jewish life. He was a disciple of Jesus, and after the resurrection had become a very vibrant preacher, teaching what's going on in the church at that time. Well, he was in Joppa, and while he was there in Joppa in the house of Simon a tanner, it was lunchtime and he was hungry. But he went upstairs on the roof, and it appears like maybe he took a nap, because it says in a trance, he saw this sheet come down out of heaven filled with all manner of unclean beasts, things that as a Jew he would have nothing to do with it. Touch not, taste not, handle not. And then a voice from heaven said, Peter, I want you to eat. Slay those animals and eat them. That was a no-no to Peter. He was appalled. Not so, Lord. I can't eat that. They're unclean. This happened three times. And the voice then said, what I have cleansed, don't you call unclean. Now, what was God preparing Peter for? Well, to Peter, the Gentiles were unclean. At the same time this was happening, an angel came and visited Cornelius, a Gentile, one that Peter would have said was unclean. And this angel told Cornelius to send to Joppa and look for a man named Peter and invite him to your house. And so while Peter was just getting over his vision, there was a knock below, and the visitors from Cornelius' house came and said, you have an invitation to the house of Cornelius. And the voice said to Peter, go with them, for I have sent them. With that background, Peter went. And as he was preaching, the Holy Spirit came down upon those unclean Gentile believers. And Peter saw that the Holy Spirit was given to them, the same as to the others at Pentecost. And he opened his mouth and said, of a truth I perceive that God is no respecter of persons. And further he said, but in every nation, he that feareth him, whether Jew or Gentile, whether Muslim or American, whether South African, Kenyan, wherever. In every nation, he that feareth God and worketh righteousness is accepted with him. But always not lost. If you have found yourself in that situation, there's good news. Confession of pride signals the beginning of the end for pride. The war is already being fought. As we read in Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24, search me, O God. And I want you to note the personal pronouns in these verses. It's not search them out there. It's search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Friends, this afternoon, there are times when we may be selfish. And that's when we come to the Lord in repentance. It's all about me and not about you. I need to come to God in that personal way. In the remaining time, I'd like to introduce a book entitled Foreign to Familiar. This is a book about reaching other cultures, and frankly, I don't think we've done very well in reaching out to other cultures. But I will say to this generation, your generation is doing much better than my generation did. There are opportunities abounding. Young people going to Bangladesh, going to Greece, going to Iraq and other places and are interacting, going to Indonesia, going to Thailand and Cambodia. The message is going out. And I think this generation has an opportunity to take the message out, but we want to be very careful that we do it in a very inoffensive way. Sarah Lanier wrote this book in helping people to reach other cultures. And to introduce the book, it might help if I read the preface to the book. She wrote this. She said, "The Delta flight was leaving on time. Three of us were strapped in, one next to the other, each finding it easy to make small talk. As the plane lifted off, so did our burdens of office work. We were off to New Mexico for a week-long conference, and our minds were filled with thoughts of mountains and crisp air and a break from the Atlanta downtown routine. So Sarah, my aisle seat colleague said in a chatty manner as a tourist on vacation, tell me, what was it like growing up in the Middle East? Of all the conversation openers, this was my least favorite. I'd been hearing it ever since moving to the States, but being in the middle seat, I couldn't escape. My desire was to respond, no, you first. Tell me what it was like growing up in a ranch-style house in suburbia. What was there to say, and who cares anyway? But I did answer, well, sort of. It was great. No, I really mean it, she insisted. What is the culture like over there? By the window seat sat Ada from Lebanon. She'd been in the States 8 years and was much more of an expert on Mideastern culture than I was. But the moment, Ada seemed fascinated with the window, so I took up the challenge. Well, I grew up in a variety of cultures. The Jewish and Arab cultures are vastly different. How so? She asked. In the Jewish culture, you say what you think. It's direct. You know where you stand with people. I glanced at her to see if she was still with me. She was, so I continued. The Arab culture, on the other hand, is much more indirect. It's all about friendliness and politeness. If offered a cup of coffee, I say, no, thank you. The host offers it again, and I decline again with something like, no, 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 don't bother yourself. He might offer a third time, and I'd reply, no, I really don't want any coffee, believe me. Then my host serves me the coffee, and I drink it. You've got to be kidding, she said. No, really. You're supposed to refuse the first few times. It's a polite thing to do. Now, Ada got into the conversation. That's incredible. I didn't know that. she said as our heads turned toward her. Ada, what do you mean you didn't know that? You're Lebanese. Yes, but I mean I didn't know that this was not normal. I'd been in the United States 8 years already and didn't realize that it was done differently here. That explains so much. I've been so lonely since moving here, and now I know why. When people in the office would ask me if I wanted to go out with them to lunch, I would say no to be polite, fully expecting them to ask me again. When they didn't and left without me, I thought they really didn't want me along and had asked me only out of politeness. In my culture, it would have been too forward to say yes the first time. And for this reason, I have very few American friends. After all these years, now I know why. I sat there stunned, pondering the sadness of her story. I said to myself, no one should have to suffer like that simply because they don't understand the culture of another. For the Adas around the world, I have written this book. The closing moments, I'm going to share just a few of the differences. That introduction already talked about direct versus indirect, but the underlying thought in her book is what she calls hot and cold climate. Now, you've heard of the South, and some of you may have traveled in Central America, and from New York to West Virginia is heading south. And when we moved from Lancaster County to West Virginia, we encountered a warmer climate. Not yet hot climate, but a warmer climate. And so our neighbors, our natives in West Virginia, when you go and ask for something or have some business to do, it might take 30 minutes. Where we are much more direct in our communication, we want to go and ask it and get it done with. The further south you go, the more that is prevalent. And so in a hot climate, the conversation is very indirect. They are more feeling-based because they don't want to offend others, so much so that they will lie to you rather than give the direct answer if they are afraid the direct answer will hurt you. So lying is seen much differently than in our climate. In a cold climate, we are task-oriented. We want to get the job done. Short, direct answers. Yes is yes, no means no. Also, the group versus the individual. Personal identity in a warm climate is tied to the group. And so, if you ask me of an opinion, I want to make sure that my family, my church group, would agree with my answer. I'm not an individual in a warm climate. So I will answer according to the group rather than my own opinions. In a cold climate, we have our own identity. We make our own decisions. And so even in a church, some of us may have strong feelings one way or the other, and we'll state our opinions regardless of what the group identity really has. Inclusion versus privacy. In my last visit to Malaysia, they put me up in an apartment building. But to make sure that I was not alone, they also had two high school boys in the room right across the hall so that I would not be alone. I didn't think of it at the time when I was there until I studied this, and then I thought, sure, I know what that's all about. They wanted to make sure that I felt included. Where we, from a cold climate, we like our privacy. It's okay to have private conversations or functions, and each person has their own possessions that they take care of. Missionaries have had their possessions stolen. Maybe I have a shovel in my tool shed that my neighbor wants, so he comes and takes it. We would say he stole it. He would say, it's ours, I borrowed it. And if you need it, you can come and borrow it back again. And so there's a vast difference in how we're looking at some of these things. Hospitality is big. In a hot climate, hospitality is spontaneous. You just drop in without an invitation. Travelers are fully provided for. When I landed at the airport in Malaysia, they came and picked me up at the airport. They took me to the apartment building and made sure I was well cared for. They provided all transportation. They took me out for breakfast. Even down to buying a SIM card for my phone, they insisted on paying for it. Everything was taken care of. Do we do that when visitors come visit us from foreign countries? In a cold climate, hospitality is planned. Before we go to your house, we'll let you know we're coming. Better yet, we wait until you invite us. Travelers are expected to make their own arrangements. Guests are expected to pay for their own transportation and food. Time and planning, we've heard some about this. They are not time-oriented, they are event-oriented and relationship-oriented. We begin things on time. Justin was ringing bells today to keep us on time, and we thank him for that. But in a warm climate, the event is important. So let's say the wedding is at 2 o'clock. We get there at 2 o'clock and nobody's there. But at 2 o'clock, maybe the bride starts getting dressed for the wedding. So to her, the wedding has begun. The cooks start cooking. The event has started. It's just not at the church yet. And so it takes hours and hours sometimes until an event actually gets started. I'm going to close with some verses from Isaiah 58. God here is contrasting fasting the traditional way. He said, "Is it such a fast that I have chosen a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast and an acceptable day of the Lord?" But he said, "Rather, is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bands of the wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke?" He said in verse 7, "Is it not to deal the bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house, when thou seest the naked, and thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh? Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of the Lord shall be thy reward." Connecting with others. Going to close with the words that I opened up with from the base of the Statue of Liberty. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." And with that, I'll turn it over to the moderator. And while he's coming up, thank you again for your attention. Thank you for your evaluations. And thank you for the offering. God bless you. It's been good to be here. Justin.